Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Auntie Bly by John Masefield. One night in the tropics, I was farmer in the middle watch. That is, I had neither wheel nor lookout to stand during the 4 hours I stayed on deck. We were running down the northeast trades, and the ship was sailing herself, and the wind was gentle, and it was very still on board, the blocks whining as she rolled, and the waves talking, and the wheel chains clanking, and a light noise aloft of pattering and tapping. The sea was all pale with moonlight, and from the lamp room door, where the watch was mustered, I could see a red stain on the water from the port side light. The mate was walking the weather side of the poop, while the boatswain sat on the booby hatch humming an old tune and making a sheath for his knife. The watch were lying on the deck, out of the moonlight, in the shadow of the break of the poop. Most of them were sleeping, propped against the bulkhead. One of them was singing a new chanty he had made, beating out the tune with his pipe stem in a quiet little voice that fitted the silence of the night. Ha ha, why don't you blow, oh ho, come roll him over, repeated over and over again, as though he could never tire of the beauty of the words and the tune. Presently he got up from where he was and came over to me. He was one of the best men we had aboard, a young Dane, who talked English like a native. We had business dealings during the dog watch, some hours before, and he had bought a towel from me, and I had let him have it cheap, as I had one or two to spare. He sat down beside me and began a conversation, discussing a number of sailor matters, such as the danger of sleeping in the moonlight, the poisons supposed to lurk in cold boiled potatoes, and the folly of having a good time in port. From these we passed to the consideration of piracy, coloring our talk with anecdotes of pirates. Ah, there was no pirate, said my friend, like old Auntie Bly of Bristol. They hung old Auntie Bly on Fernando Noronha, where the prison is, and he walked after. Auntie Bly did. That shows how bad he was. How did he walk, I asked. Let's hear about him. Oh, they just hung him, replied my friend, like they'd hang anyone else, and they left him on the gallows afterwards. They thought old Auntie was too bad to bury, I guess. There was a young Spanish captain on the island in them times. Frisco Baldo, his name was. He was a terror. So the night they hung old Auntie Frisco was getting gorgeous with some other captains in a kind of drinking shanty. And these other captains say to Frisco, I bet you a month's pay you won't go out and put a rope around Auntie's leg. And I bet you a new suit of clothes you won't put a bowline around Auntie's ankles. And I bet you a cask of wine you won't put Auntie's feet in a noose. I bet you I will, says Frisco Baldo. What's a dead man anyways, he says. And why should I be feared of a man like Auntie Bly? Give us a rope, he says, and I'll lash him up with 7 turns, like a sailor would a hammock. So he drinks up his glass and gets a stretch rope. And out he goes into the dark to where the gallows stood. It was a new moon that time, and it was as dark as the end of a sea boot and as blind as the toe. And the gallows was right down by the sea that time, because old Auntie Bly was a pirate. So he comes up under the gallows, and there was old Auntie Bly hanging. And way ho, Auntie, he says, lash and carry. Auntie, he says, I'm going to lash you up like a hammock. So he slips a bowline around Auntie's feet. Here my informant broke off his yarn to light his pipe. After a few puffs, he went on. Now, when a man's hanged in hemp, he said gravely, you mustn't never touch him with what killed him, for fear he should come to life on you. You mark that. Don't you forget it. So soon as ever Frisco Baldo sets that bowline around Auntie's feet, old Auntie looks down from his noose, and though it was dark, Frisco Baldo could see him plain enough. Thank you, young man, and auntie. Just cast that churn off again. Burn my limbs, he says, if you ain't got a neck. And now climb up here, he says, and take my neck out of the noose. I'm as dry as a cask of split peas. Now, you may guess, that Frisco Baldo feller, he come out all over in a cold sweat. Get a gait on you, says auntie. I ain't gonna wait up here to please you. So Frisco Baldo climbs up, and a sore job he has of getting the noose off auntie. Get a gait on you, says auntie, and go easy with them clumsy hands of yours. You'll give me a sore throat, he says, the way you're carrying me. Now, don't let me fall plop, says auntie. Lower way handsomely, he says. I'll make you a weary one if you let me fall plop, he says. So Frisco lowers him away handsomely, and auntie comes to the ground with a rope off him, only he still had his head to one side like he'd been hanged. Come here to me, he says. So Frisco Baldo goes over to him, and auntie, he just put one arm around his neck and gripped him tight and cold. Now march, he says. March me down to the grog shop and get me a dram. None of your six water dollops, neither, he says. I'm as dry as a foul block, he says. So Frisco and auntie, they go to the grog shop. And all the while, auntie's cold fingers was playing down Frisco's neck. And when they got to the grog shop, the captain's was all fell asleep. So Frisco takes a bottle of rum and auntie laps it down like he'd been used to it. Ah, he says, thank you, he says. And now down to the mole with you, he says, and we'll take a boat, he says. I'm gone to England, he says, to say goodbye to me mother. So Frisco, he come out all over in a cold sweat, for he was feared of the sea. But auntie's cold fingers was fiddling with his neck, so he'd think he'd better go. And when they come to the mole, there was a boat there, one of those periacs, as they call them. And auntie, he says, you take the oars, he says. I'll steer, he says. And every time you catch a crab, he says, you'll get such a welt as you'll remember. So Frisco shows her off and rows out of the harbor with old Auntie Bly at the tiller telling him to put his beef on and to watch out he didn't catch no crabs. And he rowed and he rowed and he rowed, and every time he caught a crab, whack, he had it over the sconce with a tiller. And her periac, it went a great holy big skyout, 90 knots in a quarter of an hour, so they soon sees the lights of Bristol oars. And auntie, line your oars, he said, we got away enough. Then they make her fast to a dock side, and they goes ashore, and auntie has his arms around Frisco's neck. And march, he says, step lively, he says, for Johnny's come marching home, he says. By and by they come to a little house with a light in the window. Knock at the door, says auntie. So Frisco knocks, and in they go. There was a fire burning in the room, and some candles on the table. And there by the fire was a very ugly woman in a red flannel dress, and she'd a ring in her nose and a black cutty pipe between her lips. Good evening, mother, says auntie. I come home, he says. But the old woman, she just looks at him, but never says nothing. It's your son, auntie, that's come home to see you, he says again. So she looks at him again, and aren't you ashamed of yourself, auntie, she says, coming home the way you are? Don't you repent your going ons, she says. Die in disgrace, she says, in a foreign land with none to lay you out? Mother, he says, I repent in blood, he says. You'll not deny me my rights, he says. Not since you repent, she says. Them as repents, I got no quarrels with. You was always a bad one, auntie, she says. But I hope you'd come home in the end. Well, and now you're come, she says. And I must bathe that throat of yours, she says. It looks as though you've been hit by something. Be quick, mother, he says. It's after midnight now, he says. So she washed him in wine, the way you wash a corpse, and put him in a white linen shroud with a wooden cross on his chest and two silver pieces on his eyes and a golden marigold between his lips. And together they carried him to the periac and laid him in the stern sheets. Give way, young man, she says. Give way like glory. Pull, my heart of blood, she says, or we'll have the dawn on us. So he pulls, that Frisco Baldo does, and the periac makes big southing, a degree a minute, and they come ashore at the mole, just as the hens was settling to their second sleep. "To the churchyard," says the old woman. "You take his legs." So they carries him down to the churchyard at the double. "Get a gait on you," says Auntie. "I feel a dawn in my bones," he says. "My wraith will chase you if you ain't in time," he says. And there was an empty grave, and they put him in and shoveled in the clay, and the old woman poured out a bottle on the top of it. "It's holy water," she says. "It makes his wraith rest easy." Then she runs down to the sea's edge and gets into the periac. And immediately she was hauled down beyond the horizon, and the sun come up out of the sea. And the cock cried cock-a-doodle in the hen roost, and Frisco Baldo falls down into a swoon. He was a changed man from that out. "Leave her brace," said the mate above us. "Put your chin in there and go forward to the rope." The Red Swimmer by Robert Bloch. 1. Luke Treach bowed and smirked in the Spanish sunlight at his distinguished passengers came up the gangplank. His curled and scented hair rippled most elegantly in the Caribbean breeze, a breeze that lifted the dainty ruffles at the wrists and throat of his rich velvet coat. He made a fine figure of a Spanish gentleman, did English Luke Treach, that merry morning as he stood, stroking his spade beard to hide the malicious smile which he had managed to erase from his lean, brown face, but which still persisted about his cruelly thin lips. Captain Luke Treach bowed then, as the old grandee and his daughter ascended, bowed low a second time, when the white-bearded gentleman addressed him as Captain Obispo. Treach gazed covertly into the aged, aristocratic face of his passenger, then allowed his glance to embrace the figure of the woman. Abruptly, he started, jerked, erect. Now Captain Treach had gazed on the fine ladies of old England, yes, and the plump, rosy-cheeked barmaids, too. He had even seen the dusky Caribs that danced upon the beach, in Cuba and Barbados, and the Antilles. There were dark-eyed Spanish girls that lured with sly laughter, and mulatto or mestizo maidens, savage in the charm of their delight. Captain Treach had known many women, but there was none to compare with the girl who now stood before him. Her hair was ebony over ivory forehead, her eyes dark diamonds, and lips warm ruby red. These comparisons came naturally to the captain, for his covetous nature was ever ruling, but never had it ruled him as it did at this moment. He wanted this girl, with her maiden beauty of face and her slim, young, untaught body curved and lissom for delight. Young, dark, smiling, body of Christ, the captain swore inwardly as his lips shaped their polite greeting. Courteously, he welcomed Señor Montelupe and his daughter to the ship. Yes, their cabins were in readiness, and he trusted that they would be comfortable. But certainly, they would cast off at once, and might the blessed Savior speed them on a prosperous, untroubled voyage to Mother Spain. Guns and men there? Yes, for there were pirates. Cursed scoundrels, these buccaneers. And if they attacked, it was best to be ready, though gracious God forbid. Captain Treach escorted Señor Montelupe and his daughter to their cabins, then returned to watch his bullies bring up the chests and bags his passengers brought with them. Chests and bags, silk, satin, gold, jewels. It made Treach smile. He smiled again as he thought of pirates. The second smile made his wolfish face assume an almost beneficent aspect, for it was a charitable smile of one well pleased with himself. And Captain Luke Treach, now known as Captain Obispo, but more famous as English Luke, had good reason to respect his cleverness. First, he had taken the galleon. Few men had been lost, much wealth gained. After efficiently disposing of the crew and their captain, he had hit upon a brilliant idea. Instead of careening off some inlet and waiting until intermediaries reached him to buy and dispose of his loot, he would seek a regular port. The galleon Golden Crest had been bound for Veracruz. Very well, he would sail for Veracruz, rig himself out in the captain's garb, and dress his men according to Spanish style. He and his mates spoke the tongue well. With a little careful disguise, they could pass the Spaniards. On reaching port, they could dispose of their cargo, cash in the booty, and sail away again swiftly with no one the wiser. Better still, the appearance of the ship would preclude any fuss such as might be occasioned by its disappearance. There would be no reprisal, no scouring of the seas by Spanish fleets in search of English Luke, the buccaneer. A noble idea. Luke Treach thought at the time, and it had worked. With a common seaman kept on shipboard against any betrayal, he and his lieutenants had entered town. Officials had even been permitted to land on the ship and inspect it. Trade had been accomplished without suspicion, and Luke was ready to sail. Then Comandante Portis had asked him to take passengers. At first, Luke demurred, until he had learned that Señor Montelupe and his daughter were returning to Spain with all their wealth. They wanted to leave at once. He had been an official, and there was some scandal. Wealthy. Scandal meant money. It would be brought aboard ship. Luke Treach agreed, and the affair was settled. Now they were ready to set sail, and more luck he had befallen the clever captain, this daughter of Montelupe. She was a new treasure, another prize. So, Treach smiled indulgently when he thought of his cunning and what it had gained for him. But, ever businesslike, his musing abruptly ceased and his thoughts turned to the exigencies of the moment. He gave the order to lift anchor in the clarion voice for which he was justly famous. A moment later, he proved his English erudition in the matter of cursing as he loosed a fine volley of oaths at the half-naked seamen straining at the ropes on deck. Then Captain Treach sauntered below, gentlemanlike, pausing merely to kick aside the sailor who chanced to stray across his path, carrying a spar piece. He rapped discreetly on the cabin door, spat out his plug of tobacco, and entered the Montelupe quarters. The old man greeted him, but Captain Treach had eyes only for the appointments he found therein, for the piles of brocaded and jeweled cloth now removed from their wrappings and stacked against the wall, for the jewel caskets and the ingots in the rough sea bags. And then he stared at Inez Montelupe, stared with the selfsame avidity. All the while he spoke graciously enough to the old fool, but his gaze burned a blush into the girl's cheeks, and he thought of the night. Not tonight, but the next, when they would be past hail or chance of pursuit. He chatted for perhaps an hour. Yes, he had an excellent voyage out. No, his passage had been free of storm or danger from freebooters, though that cursed Blackbeard was reputed to be in these waters. He fabricated news from Spain, glibly explained the death at sea of the ship's padre. He was forced to do most of the talking, for the dotish old man merely stared at him with his liquid, curiously youthful brown eyes. Treach didn't like that stare. It held a faint tinge of contempt or amusement, but then he would not have to put up with it for long. On this thought, he took his departure, after graciously asking their attendants at dinner in his own quarters. Upstairs, the gentlemanly mood left him, and he called for rum and his lieutenant, Roger Grote. Grote shambled into his cabin, mouthing oaths and damnations, because the lace frippery at his wrist dangled into his tankard while he was drinking. The red-bearded lieutenant made it known that he was sick of wearing these thrice-damned Spanish bangles, and the men were tired of the masquerade as well. They grumbled because they weren't put ashore to amuse themselves with the proceeds of the plunder. To this information, Captain Treach listened with occasional frowns. Then he told Grote that they would sail on only another day, dispose of the old fool and head in for the nearest island, a few hours off to position at that time. "Rich, isn't he?" muttered Grote. "Blackie and Tom swore he had bouillon in those bags of his." He chuckled, then snickered as he brought a hairy paw down on the table at which they sat. "And the girl's a beauty by God. And they'll be rare sport." Captain Treach raised his hand. A slight gesture, but the accompanying frown was enough to quell the big man into silence. "The girl is mine," he snapped. "Mine alone. The swag will divide according to our articles, but the girl is mine. You and the others will have your fill of wenching when we put in, but she's mine." Grote could not restrain a hoarse chuckle. "I don't envy her at that. Remember Lucy on the English ship we took? When you finished with her and Salvatore tried to take her, you flayed the lass, and I warrant this one would prefer the crew's sport to the other end." Captain Treach smiled. "Tell Salvatore I want wine for dinner. Amontillado, I want my guests to eat, drink, and be merry tonight." They both laughed. Two. They both laughed. This Captain Obispo was certainly a witty man, and tonight he was outdoing himself. Señorita Inez found her first instinct of dislike fading, though she still felt a tinge of strange panic whenever his beady eyes rested too intently upon her face or bosom. As for Señor Montelupe, his taciturn stare waned under the brandy and the mellow Amontillado sherry. His reserve down, he proceeded to let his host guide the conversation into personal channels. Captain Treach asked him about his duties in Veracruz, learned that the old man had held a secretarial post for years and owned several lucrative mines. There had been a scandal of sorts. Money, the captain presumed. No, not exactly money. The old man's threatenings held him silent for a moment, but the wine, the courtesy, the mood urged him on. His bright eyes grew shadowy as he spoke. Was the captain a churchgoer? Something in the shadowed eyes cued Treach to ignore. The natural line speak truly. No, he was not a son of the Mother Church. That was well, said Señor Montelupe, for there was a charge against him. A charge of sorcery. Yes, the black arts, as ignorant fools called them, the mantic arts. He had studied with the Moorish masters in Spain as a youth, not wizardry or witchcraft, but the true magics that lie in nature. Aromancy, the controlling of winds. Hydromancy, divination and command of waters. Pyromancy, the lore of fire. It was science, not sorcery, which he sought to rule, and the ancient Moors held secrets of natural wisdom known to seers before Solomon. Here, in this new world, he had availed himself of his governmental position to study certain things. It would be wise for one so old to take heed of the elixir vitae, the elixir of life. And native blood was cheap. Slaves and peons, dried by the dozens in the mines each day, perished by flogging and torture. He had meant no harm. He wanted to kill no one, but merely to study the blood of a few slaves, to experiment with revivification of the dead. That did no harm. And he had discovered things. Marvelous secrets gathered from the wisdom of Egypt's, the Orient, the Arab sages. In his hand, he could use this knowledge for good, not evil. But the natives complained. The people whispered, and the alcalde told the padre, who in turn brought tidings to the comandante. And so Señor Montelupe had given up his post, taken his daughter, his wife was dead these many years, alas, and departed for home. Luke listened with a polite show of interest. No need to antagonize the old duffer. He and his talk of magic? But then, what could one expect from a bloody Spaniard? Those fools were all alike with their inquisition, witch-burning, and alchemy. Alchemy. The thought crossed his mind even as he nodded in polite assent to the grandee's words. Alchemy. The transmutation of base metals into gold, wasn't it? Perhaps the stupid southern dog knew something. Best to draw him out. Luke drew him out, aided by further draughts of wine. He politely hinted that a man of Señor Montelupe's wisdom must have uncovered secrets in his quest of baleful knowledge. Señor Montelupe stroked his gray beard as he replied that he had uncovered secrets. His eyes flamed with a bright gleam of fanaticism as he leaned across the great cabin table. He, Montelupe, has succeeded in his experiments. Men has sought the elixir of life for centuries untold, without avail. Charm, incantation, invocation, all methods had failed. But he had come to a new world, and there his efforts had been crowned with triumphs. It was a great discovery. Much toil and study had gone into it, and not a little blood. It was not generally known, but his wife had died from an injection of a spurious elixir he had compounded in earlier studies. Since then, the tragic failure had spurred him on, and many slaves had been sacrificed to the attainment of perfection. But he had done it. There was a vial filled with a golden liquid, not the mythical water of poor Ponce de Leon's fountain of youth, but the veritable elixir vitae. Its compoundment had cost Señor Montelupe many years of his life, but now, when he returned to Spain with his wealth, he and his daughter would be insured eternity. Eternity in which to study, to seek further wisdom. Luke Treach frowned and swore damnation to himself. The blasted idiot was mad. No alchemical secrets here, no philosopher's stone or anything real.
Only this demented gibberish about some crazy scheme of perpetual life. The Spanish dog bored him. For that, he would pay on the morrow. And she would pay too, Inez, listening with a cryptic smile that implied belief in her father's words, and a covert glimmer in her eyes which proclaimed that she thought the captain an ignorant fool, incapable of understanding the magnitude of her sire's secrets. Yes, he would pay, and she would pay, though in sweeter coinage. With that thought in his politely phrased adieu, Luke Treach strode up deck for a breath of fresh air, air untainted by this fool's talk of wizardry and enchantment. He checked the position, oversaw the change of watch at the wheel, and retired to sleep against the morrow's sport. Night clouds had scudded before the dawn, and the sun ruled azure southern heavens ere he awoke. The cabin window showed him the beauty of sea and sky, but his ears heard sounds most unlovely. This was the day, and the men were drunk. Grote had evidently broken out the rum. Cursing, Treach ran up on deck and found shambles. The Golden Crest drifted, unpiloted. Laughing, gleeful men overran the ship, moving about at will, or clustering before the broached cask that stood upon the after deck. The English sea dogs had abandoned their Spanish costumes in favor of pirate regalia, or utter nakedness. Treach saw his steward, Salvatore, slopping rum over his maroon coat with the white piping, then wiping his red mouth with a lacy sleeve that had once graced the arm of a Portuguese admiral of war. He saw Roger Grote slapping his naked tattooed thigh with a flat of a cutlass as he danced about, one light. Samuel Flew, whose black eye patch was the sole incongruous note in the ensemble he wore, the grotesque finery of some silken lady whose denuded body had long since passed to the mercies of the sharks. The rest roared and bellowed forth crude jibes or shouted toasts over the swelling of their tankards. Treach paused. The men had broken discipline, but they were in jovial mood and order could be restored. But what matter? Their drinking could have waited until night, as planned, but a few hours made no difference now. Let them have their sport. And he? Now he could go below and seek Inez. He went, smiling. Inez and her father were staring out of the window, their eyes veiled with perplexity. "What does this mean, Captain?" asked the old man. And Treach entered, then his face betrayed that he knew the answer. For Treach had entered without knocking, and he had entered not as Captain Obispo, but as English Luke, swaggering. He smiled, a sneer. "What does this mean?" Inez echoed in a faint voice that trailed away beneath the intensity of Treach's stare. Treach laughed. "Mean? It means a lot, I fancy. Firstly, that you've made a mistake in taking passage with us. You see, we've changed our colors. We're an English crew, not Spanish. And we fly still. A third flag today. Fancy. Have you heard of the Jolly Roger?" He grinned. His bow was a mockery of previous courtliness. "So, it's English Luke Treach at your service today, my friends." "Buccaneer," the old Spaniard scowled and drew Inez close to his side. She trembled in her father's arms, but her terror invested her with a weird enhancing of beauty, the beauty of a frightened fawn. Luke stared at the softness of her black eyes, at the trembling of her fear-taught body. He stared so closely that he did not see the sudden gesture of the old man, did not observe his hand slip a tiny golden vial from his pocket to the bodice of his daughter. He stared at the girl, and then he began to laugh. The laugh told all. It told Señor Montelupe that he need not waste words in threats or pleas. It told Inez Montelupe that which made her crimson with shame. Laughing, the pirate advanced. This time he saw the second movement of the old man, saw the silver dagger slid from the sleeve and raised on high. But his laughter did not cease as he tore the cutlass from its scabbard at his side. The blade slashed down upon the Spaniard's wrist. When it struck, it seemed as though the steel had sent sparks flying. But it was only blood spurting forth in tiny gouts as the hand fell severed to the cabin floor. The old man cried out. Then Luke was upon him, lifting the graybeard bodily and carrying him from the cabin. On deck, he collared Roger Grote and kicked the form of the fainting grandee to indicate his prize. "Amuse yourself," he instructed the lieutenant. "I go below again." Amuse yourself, parroted Grote, leering. Treach good-naturedly pushed the man in the face with the flat of his wet blade and went down the stairs again. Once more he entered to the cabin and saw that Inez stood there. She faced him now, and she did not cringe. Her features held no fear, for they were set in the immobility of death. Only her eyes were alive, so dreadfully, so intently alive, that Luke Treach stood staring aghast into their black depths. His own face twisted as though seared by the black flame that leapt forth from her burning orbs. Then he mastered himself and advanced. "You'd best pull no tricks with me, girl," he muttered. Her dead face smiled a dead smile, the mirthless smile of a corpse that crawls to feed, and her voice spoke, muffled as though it came from the under-earth. "I fear ye not," said Inez. "I fear no man and no thing. Ye had best fear me." Her tone was leaden, and the words were heavy against Luke's ear. He grimaced, shrugged in a bravado he did not feel. "Enough of this," he growled. "Come, lass. Wait." Luke paused. "Ye shall have will over me if ye must. But dog though thou art, I warn thee still. My father gave me this." She held up the little golden vial. It was empty. "Ye heard what it contained. The precious distillation which ensures eternal life. I drank of it, and so I warn thee. I cannot die. The hatred within me cannot die. Use me as thou wilt. Ye cast me into the sea." Her eyes flamed, "but I shall return. Luke Treach, I shall return, and there will be reckoning." For a moment, the buccaneer trembled with an instinctive horror. Then the wine mounted to his brain, and as the light faded from the girl's eyes, he stepped across the cabin with a hoarse laugh. Inez threw the empty vial in his face, but he only grinned. 3. Luke Treach stumbled from the cabin with a curse, stumbled with the body of the swooning girl across his shoulder. Lurching figures moved in the dusk, snarling and laughing in drunken animation. Treach cursed savagely as he sought the deck and made for a group of huddling men that clustered about the mast. He was rather surprised to see that old Señor Montelupe was still alive, considering what had been done to him. The old grandee was nailed to the mast most painfully by his remaining hand. The men turned to Treach and regarded him with bleary eyes. "What do we do, Captain?" demanded Grote, moving to the pirate's side. "A tough old bird, this vulture. He'll not die, and he'll not be still. He hangs there and curses and prays in his Spanish. Damn if he don't." Treach smiled wolfishly. "Perhaps I can devise a new diversion," he said. There was snickering, for the buccos knew their captain. They watched as he threw the swooning Inez to the deck, and the mangled head of Montelupe turned to follow Treach's movements. The captain's knife flashed, and the anguished old man moaned aloud as he cast the terribly altered form over the vessel's side. Then Treach faced the father. The gray Spaniard stared from tortured eyes until Luke's face fell in shame. "Fool!" The voice rang faint, but vibrant with hatred. "Fool!" Luke wished to turn away, but those eyes, that voice, held him prisoner before the victim. "There is vengeance for fools," hissed the old man. "I've prayed to the powers while your dogs tormented me. Prayed to powers over wind and water. You and your curlish crew are doomed, I swear, and your torment shall not end there." Was this racked horror really smiling? Luke shuddered. He stepped forward, belching at the madman's eyes, for the old man was mumbling. To the crew it appeared as if Montelupe were whispering in confidence to Treach, for the captain bent his head close to the ravaged face and the Spaniard's lips moved. It was hard to hear what he was saying. "Vengeance? My daughter? Elixir? Nothing can stop life that will flow eternally through veins. Nothing can stop hate. Vengeance for you. Return." In the gathering shadow, it was difficult for the men to see the expression on their captain's face. Could it be fear at the dying man's whispers? But a moment later, everyone witnessed their captain's rage, for suddenly the horrid head writhed as the old Spaniard spat full in Treach's face. Then a sword flashed out, and a red daubed head rolled across the deck. At that moment, the sky bled, and crimson waters bubbled against the sunset. When the main body went over the side, the water stirred with a new turbulence and the wind sprang up from the flaming western sky. Treach shuddered, even as he cursed, noting the silence of his companions, their furtive looks and gesturings. The imbecile had awed them with his curses. Faith, but it was lucky they had not heard what the old devil had said there at the last. Still, his wizard babbling was working on these superstitious fools. With an effort, Luke met the mood and mastered it. He shouted for fresh rum, roundly cuffed the nearest members of the crew, and swaggered forward. After a time, his mates followed, and the warm bite of the liquor soon banished morbid melancholy. They drank, as sunset smoldered into dusk, drank as the dark clouds of night fled before the rise of wailing winds, drank even as the waters lashed the ship through trough and swell. For now white waves raced and reared, and the sea began to boil and bubble, as though heated at some devil's cauldron from below. Near midnight, the storm broke, and the rain lashed the drunken roisterers from the deck. It was then that several awoke from their bemusement, but it was too late. The Golden Crest whirled in an angry sea amidst the wind that shrieked and tore as sail and spar. Treach roared futile orders to the scant dozen of his crew that he could muster, but these did not avail. No one dared go aloft or brave the gale above the deck. Even when the mast fell, the panic-crazed men were helpless to forestall further disaster. The black night hailed about them, and the sea surged over the decks as the ship heeled against the storm. Floundering figures were tossed screaming over the side as the waters retreated. Cursing sailors blundered in the darkness as the yardarms crashed about them to splinter the deck and cabins into shambles. Some there were who made a break for the boats. Five or six lifted one over the side and clambered in just as a new wave struck. They dashed to death against the bows as the craft smashed to bits before the flooding impact of the water. The ship lurched madly. It was leaking, foundering. That was a certainty. Treach, Collard, Roger Grote, Salvatore, Samuel Slew, and as many others as he could shake into consciousness. His orders were curt, oath-weighted. They dashed below, returning with rations, water jugs. A great combining wave crashed over the deck, then subsided as the men dashed for another boat. They made it, lowered the ropes and floundered in, casting off just in time to escape the flooding fury that spent itself against the vessel's side. Rowing was madness in the swirling water, but they pushed away in time. Already the great vessel was rearing and plunging in the throes of final surrender. It rose and sank, and above the storm came the sound of faint shrieks, as though left behind realized the imminence of their doom. Then, with a geyser burst, the waters boiled above the ship, poising against the ruined mast stumps before they hurled down to smash the vessel to ruins. With a rumble they fell and claimed their own. The craft rose up, tilted at the bow, and fell into the gigantic trough as the wave crashed down upon it. There was a single mighty roar of triumph as the ship slid into the sea. Then foaming water closed about it, and the terrible circle spread and widened from the point of its disappearance. Treach and the men met the shock, though two yammering forms disappeared under the drenching violence of the inundation and were sucked down by the hungry depths. Then they tossed all alone in the black storm amidst the sound of gigantic laughter, and the booming wind mocked them through the night. 4. It was Comet's death the next morning, and the waves purred against the side of the boat as though in satisfaction at the appeasement of their hunger. The weary men slept as the sun rose. Treach huddled forward over the provisions. Roger Grote bent over his oar. Salvatore stretched across the seat. Sam Slew and Gorlak lying supine in the dampness at the bottom of the craft. It was Gorlak who woke first. Gorlak, the gigantic croon man. His brutal face wrinkled into a frown as he surveyed his sleeping companions and the empty sea in which they drifted. Then his eyes fell upon the two water casks, the old sea bag of provisions at the captain's side. He stretched forward arms, ate, and drank noisily. Treach chose this moment to awake, and for a moment he stared at the giant man, who sat obliviously munching a slab of bully beef. Then he snarled an oath and drew his knife. In a moment he had flung himself forward on the startled man and buried his blade in the gleaming column of the corded neck. Gorlak grunted in pain and crushed the captain's body in a terrible embrace. His arms tightened as Treach tore the knife from the wound in the neck and stabbed again and again at his back. The man, grimacing with mad pain, locked his great hands about the pirate's neck and squeezed terribly with sobs of agony as he sought to throttle his foe. Then Treach slid the knife around the ribs, arched upward in a silver slash, and disemboweled his antagonist. The eight paws relaxed their grip, and the captain slid the twitching body over the side. It fell with a splash and disappeared. The captain crawled back to his place, feeling his throat experimentally to make sure that all was well. Then polishing his knife carefully on his breeches, he looked up to face the stares of his awakened companions. The scuffle had taken place so quickly that the men were still rubbing their eyes and grumbling their bewilderment. "Gorlak's gone," announced Treach in a harsh voice, "and damn my lights and liver, the rest of your curs will go too if I catch you tampering with the provisions." He took out a small stone from his blouse and began to sharpen his knife, gazing menacingly at his audience. They sat stolid, each man looking off into the empty sea and thinking his own thoughts. Luke mused with the rest. His mind was teeming in turmoil. First thoughts were pangs of regret as he remembered the fine ship, the fine crew he had lost, and more tragic still, the stores of bullion and silver ingots, the money chests gleaned from trading off loot for gold doubloons and pieces of eight, and there had been a small fortune in the silks and jewels and monies left by his two passengers as well. It was all lost. Further reflection was brought to bear on his own plight, adrift here in the boundless sea, with three men, an open boat, and water and provisions for perhaps 2 days. From these ponderings, his thoughts strayed off into darker considerations. Luke Treach was a practical man and an all-around materialistic scoundrel to boot, but he could not help but remember the strange dying words of the Spaniard, "He who claimed mantic powers." The wretch may have been raving, but he spoke of aeromancy, power over wind and water, and of conjuring up a storm. The storm had come, and the seer had cursed him with other things. But enough. A little food, a little water, a few attempts at formulating a plan, these were the things he needed to drive such foolishness from his brain. His apportion, a meager fare of beef and hardtack to the three survivors of his crew, and snapped orders for rowing assignments and night watches. Dark grinning Salvatore, big dour groat, and the leanly sinister dead light slew, listened stolidly to his commands and set to. But rowing is onerous, and the broiling sun of the mid-Caribbean no kindly overseer. The sea is a lonely place, and last night these men had glimpsed death with jaws agape to swallow. Now they feared that those jaws would close about them again, not to engulf but to gnaw slowly the sharp teeth of thirst and hunger. The day passed in sullen, apprehensive silence. Groat and Slew, then Treach and Salvatore, taking the oars while the alternate pair rested and tried to shield their eyes from the eternal glare. Row, but where? There was no compass, and until the star shone, guidance was missing. Treach hoped to put south to the islands, and the sun's deceptive shimmer showed him the way none too truly. Nevertheless, the labor kept the men from thinking too much, kept them from remembering little things that now came to slyly torment Treach. There had been a little golden vial, and the wizard had sworn a vengeance. What was that about eternal life? Couldn't torture kill? What did it mean? Sunset again. Flaming sunset like that in which Montelupa had died. He had died. The dead harmed no one. She too could harm no one now. But it was night. Captain Treach apportioned the food in darkness, watched his companions at the water to ensure that they were not over greedy. Treach snapped commands, set the course by the stars. The men hauled at the oars in silence, and the boat glided through black waters. Groat and Slew labored. Salvatore dropped off to sleep, his swarthy face burned in his hands as he huddled up against the forward seat. Treach kept awake by sheer will, cursing mechanically at the oarsmen so that the sound of his voice might break the sound of the silence the empty silence of rolling waters. The very rustle and lap of the waves seemed to become a part of a maddening stillness that sapped the mind. The night sea was an entity that crawled about them. Treach felt this, although no concrete thought was formulated, but his instinct awakened him to fear. Fear when the silent sea, now personified. Here, drifting alone in the black infinitude, the power of which the dead wizard had spoken assumed a new reality. It was easy for the tired imagination to conceive of vast pulsing shapes, embodiments of the night and the wind and water. Treach felt his burning forehead, drew the back of his hands over lips cracked with fever. He fell asleep while the waters murmured. In his dreams, the water was whispering. From far away, it whispered from behind the boat. The whispering grew louder. It was right behind the boat now. He could almost hear words floating up out of the water. The whispering was trying to tell him something. Something about vengeance and a curse right under the boat now. There was a scream of utter agony. Treach wrenched himself from sleep, sat bolt upright as the scream trailed off into a gurgling noise in the blackness. "What's that?" he shouted to his companions. For a moment, there was no answer. Groat's face was buried in trembling hands. Salvatore heard him, but when he opened his mouth, it merely hung loosely, without moving in speech, and Slew was gone. "Where's Sam?" shouted Treach. Salvatore managed to regain partial control of his jaws. He gone, the swarthy man spluttered. "It came over the side and took him, and then it pulled him into the water. It took him. Santo Dios." Then Treach was upon Salvatore, shaking his shoulders and shrieking into his very face. "What took him, damn me? Speak up, man, for the love of heaven." "I not know," whimpered the other. "I not know. We row here and then Slew stop rowing. I take the oar. He just sit there at end of boat. All at once he says, 'Listen,' he says, 'I hear whisper.' I tell me crazy. But he just sit and look at water and say, 'It's getting louder.' All at once he lean down and then, Sacramento, two arms come up out of the water and go around his neck. He just scream once and then over the side he go. No splash, no bubbles. He go and I see arms. All red arms. All red." As the big man slumped down in the boat, Treach peered wildly at the black waters about him. They were still unruffled. No body, no rippling. "You're daft, man," he whispered, but there was no conviction in his voice. "Those red arms," Roat muttered from behind. "I never believed in mermaids or sea monsters, but..." "Shut up, both of you. You're crazy. Slew fell overboard, that's all. Fever's got you. There's nothing in the water but sharks, and they have no arms." "You threw something in the water with arms," Salvatore mumbled. Treach struck the man across the mouth. "Shut up!" he screamed. "Let me alone!" Silently he sat there until dawn arose, and when he saw its redness, he shuddered. They were all mad now, food and water gone, Slew gone and the sun searing down, cooked the madness into their brains until thoughts writhed and twisted amidst flames. Salvatore wouldn't row anymore. He kept staring at the water behind the boat while Treat watched him. Toward midday, Salvatore turned. "There," he whispered. I know it come. I see it. There in the water. It following us. Swimming in water. Oh, Captain, look there. Shut up." But Treach looked. It was only sylight glinting on the waves behind. "Look, it move again." Something was moving way back. "Sharks, you fool. Sharks are not red. Shut up." They pulled the oars, but Salvatore gazed back as sunset dripped blood upon the waves. He was trembling and his face was soaking in perspiration, not born of heat alone. "Let us all stay awake tonight," he whispered. "Maybe we pray and it go away. Otherwise..." "Quiet!" Treach snapped, like a man with his old authority. But the authority was in his voice alone now. Inside, Luke Treach was afraid. When the sun went down, he heard the whispering at once. It welled out of the black waters, and he prayed that the moon might rise at once. Hearing that whispering in the blackness was too much, he turned toward the back of the boat. He talked to Salvatore. Anything. Just drown out that growing whisper. He turned and saw. The big man was on his knees. He was leaning over the gunwale. His arms were outstretched, and he was staring down into the black water, his face icy with horror. And two arms were rising out of the water. Two long red arms. They were pinkly phosphorescent in the darkness. They glowed like stripped flesh. The arms reached out. Twin serpents that embraced Treach tried to call out, to motion to Groat. He was frozen in the arms that rose, embraced Salvatore. And silently the big man toppled over the side. The splash broke the spell. Quick! Treach screamed out. Groat followed him, on his hands and knees as they thrashed their oars in the blackness of the waves. Nothing moved. Sharks move a lot, Groat muttered in a hoarse voice. Sharks moving. Octopus move. But this, you saw?
I didn't see anything, Treach lied.
He was mad, threw himself over.
Drowning men move, Groat croaked.
Treach mastered himself. Row, he commanded, for God's sake, row, man. We must reach land before tomorrow night.
They rowed as though death were at their heels, and in their hearts it was this they feared.
They rowed past midnight, tired, feverish, aflame with thirst and hunger. But fear called their strokes, and fear drove the boat on through the inky, whispering waters. Treach was nearly mad now. There was something out there. He could no longer keep from thinking of the curse of what Inez had said about not being able to die. Yet he had killed her. What he did would kill anyone. She must be dead.
What's that? Groat had stopped rowing.
Where? Back there in the water. See? Where the moonlight hits the wave.
I don't see.
Treach stopped, eyes wide with dread.
Yes, you do. You see it, that head coming toward us.
They sat there while the bobbing thing approached, and the whispering rose about them in a great murmur as of winds rising from ocean depths, and the whispering was clear this time so that they heard.
Where are you, Luke Treach?
I come for you. You have taken my eyes, Luke Treach, and I cannot see. But you are there, and I come for you.
Groat began to laugh. A low chuckling rose from his throat until it drowned out the sound of the whispering.
Groat raised his head to the moon and bayed his laughter. He sat there quaking with mirth, and Treach watched him, then watched the bobbing head that circled the boat. It went around twice. It stopped for a moment on his side, and he saw dark, seal-like outline that might or might not have been human. It hesitated in the water, and Treach drew his knife. Then it circled the boat again and came to rest on the side where Groat sat laughing. Two arms rose out of the water in the moonlight, two red arms glistening and wet, and Groat went over, still laughing. His laughter rose, then bubbled away as the water dragged him down. It was then that Treach himself began to laugh. All alone in the boat, he sat laughing up to the moon. He laughed because he knew he was mad, and yet he could not escape. Luke Treach seized an oar and began to row with demented fury. The sun was high when he ceased. Madness passed, and the events of the night were a dream. Treach leaned back, rubbed his eyes, and looked around in amazement.
Groat? Salvatore, Slew, where are you?
They were gone.
But they couldn't be gone, or it would be true.
Groat, Salvatore, Slew. And then the waves around the boat parted, and three heads appeared in the water. Sam Slew's one-eyed stare came from a blue, bloated face. Salvatore's eyes were closed, and his mouth was sealed with seaweed. The drowned visage of Groat, smiling through a tangle of kelp, bobbed horridly on the waves. All three heads came to the side of the boat. They shimmered there through the haze of heat from the sun. Treach had been screaming for a long time in a high, shrill voice when they disappeared.
Fever, he muttered. Just one day more.
He clawed at the oars. But now he couldn't keep his eyes off the water. And as noon approached, he could begin to see the swimmer behind, far off, crawling through the trough of waves. It was keeping distance but a few strokes, and it would be upon him. The delirious pirate redoubled his efforts,
With every ounce of remaining strength, still the gap between boat and swimmer narrowed. Now Treach could see long red arms in the water. He could not make out a head or face, but he saw the arms. Remembering what he had done, he shuddered. Red arms. He faced the sunset. A black bulk loomed from the water to his west. Dominica, he guessed. If he could make it before nightfall, he would be safe. He rowed on faster. The swimmer was fast, too. The gap narrowed, just as the red band of sunset narrowed. How can she follow, Treach muttered. She's blind. I know that. She took the others, searching for me. How can she follow? Wizard tricks, that vile. Why didn't I believe it would keep her alive, even after that? I must row harder. Panting, the wrecked body of Luke Treach tugged at the oars. His bloodshot eyes stared now at the bobbing head just behind the boat. His ears buzzed, but he heard the whisperings. I swore it, Luke Treach. Now I come for you. There was no use to row, but Treach rowed. No use to scream, but Treach screamed. Screamed and rowed as the red thing swam around the boat. Then it was crawling over the side, and Luke Treach avoided the pinkish-red arms as they reached out. Laughing, he drew his knife. But then it crawled into the boat so that Treach saw it drown, yet livid all over. And he pointed the knife, but it came on, eyeless and groping. One hand grasped the knife, and then both arms went around Luke Treach, so that he fell back. The hand grasping the knife came down, and a voice whispered, I came a long way from death itself, and now I shall do to you what you did to me before you cast me over the side. You shall be as red as I am. And the knife sang down as Luke Treach's knife had sung down when he killed Inez before her father and cast her into the sea. It sang down, and when it ceased, the red swimmer went over the side of the drifting boat and disappeared. Night fell, and still the boat drifted. At dawn it bumped ashore. Two men found it there some hours later. They peered into it and shuddered at the sight of the figure lying on the bottom of the boat. Dead? Whispered one. Of course he's dead. Racked doubtless in an open boat? Yes. His voice was vibrant with horror, but what could have done this to him? Just what was done? I cannot understand it yet. The first man stared again at the red thing in the boat. You fool, he said. Can't you see that this man was flayed alive?